pleasure. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with Sky Jatani and Christian Taylor, but she's not on mic today because we only have three mics, and we had to give our mic to our special guest who's going to be with us for the entire podcast, Mr. Eric Metaxas. So before we start, we need our theme song. Here's the theme song. It goes something like this. Hey, it's a podcast. What do you know? Hey, it's a podcast. So there's no video. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. We'll talk to Sky and Christian too. And Eric Metaxas here for you. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. The Phil Vischer podcast starts right here. Okay. Thanks. Thank you for stifling your applause.
We don't want to encourage it, Phil.
I know.
I'm not supposed to talk yet because you haven't introduced me,
yeah.
So I won't say anything.
Okay, that's good. Try to keep it that way. We are here with Sky. You know Sky, pastor, speaker, author, philanthropist. And we're here with Eric Metaxas. Eric Metaxas is an old friend of mine, going back about 14, 13 years, I believe. He is best known now. In fact, if you've heard of him, you probably know him from his biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which has made his world explode with joy and happiness. Or not. But he actually does much more than that, and we're mostly going to talk. He's here. He's in town. He came out to be on the talk show tonight. We're filming another test of the talk show, but we thought we'd do a podcast while we was here. So, Eric Metaxas, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe that that you're really named Sky. Did your parents name you Sky?
Oh, you want that story now? It's actually
I wouldn't go that far, no.
It's actually a nickname.
Okay, all right. And is the spelling a nickname?
You know what? The nickname was given to me when I was born, and my mother threw an E on there, and she's never given me a satisfying answer as to why there's an E.
Okay.
Hmm.
Well, that's good enough for me.
She's a free thinker?
Something like that.
Or
it is an interesting story, which I will share with you at some other point, but I don't want to take attention away.
Right.
I'd like to have a podcast, and I can have you on, and we can talk about that.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Deal.
That's a great idea. Does that mean I'm out?
You're out of this one. It's all going to be about his name and the letter E.
Dang. Don't you hate it when you throw a party and the guests decide that the next party you won't be invited to?
Exactly.
But I'm glad you guys got to know each other at my expense. Eric, you have, I think, kind of an interesting story because you're a bit of an unusual conservative Christian.
Yes. I'm eclectic.
Yeah. Eclectic, I think, is an understatement.
Yeah. Broad, shallow.
Yeah.
Scattered, I think, is the word. In the original Greek, it's scattered.
Schizophrenic.
Scattered, yeah.
And by the way, I met the original Greek.
Really?
Yeah, I grew up with him. Incredible.
Aren't you an original Greek?
Yeah. You? Well, my dad is Greek. My mom is German.
Okay.
But,
multi-ethnic.
Wow, more multi-ethnicity.
Yeah.
Sky
is what?
I'm ambiguously ethnic.
He's Hindu-Swedish.
Yeah, that's just so cool. Is that intentional?
Well, I didn't choose it,
didn't plan that?
It wasn't a government experiment.
It was a divine intention, I guess.
It just seems like one of those things. It's like, I want to be named Sky, I want to shave my head, and I want to be Hindu and Scandinavian.
That was the plan. I was about in kindergarten.
It's incredible.
And I thought, that's my destiny.
It's like a cheesy sci-fi thriller, like we're going to design someone to reach the young evangelicals.
Yeah,
we want
right.
to be hip ethnically.
Right.
We want
it's like,
Hindu
like
in the background.
Francis Chan. It's like Francis Chan. It's like, okay, I want to cross Billy Graham with Jackie Chan.
Exactly.
And that will be cool.
And we'll call him Francis Chan.
We'll call him Francis.
A whole different demographic that we cannot reach
with
people who don't have the kind of Hindi thing in their background.
So right.
It's incredible.
For the new listeners, Sky is not Hindu today. He's a practicing Christian.
My father's from India.
Yes.
I have a lot of Hinduism and interesting religious backgrounds.
It's in the background.
My mother is Swedish, Norwegian, English, Scandinavian primarily. My middle name is Charles, which is actually my Norwegian grandfather's name. Yeah.
Has anyone ever called you Skychuck?
No.
So that,
but you're welcome to.
That dark, all that Hindi stuff is in your past, right?
What's in my family?
You're not bringing that to the table here.
Well, I do.
Okay. I just want to say I'm no longer doing crack cocaine because I know he said I couldn't get on the podcast if I was still active, an active user. And Phil, I'm just telling you.
He passed his test.
No.
Thank you.
Cup is in the bathroom.
That's in the past.
Praise God.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. So you said you had an interesting flight? in here? You flew in for the show?
I had an interesting flight. And it's a classic thing. I was, you know, thrilled because now I fly Delta enough that I was able to be first class today. And I'm in first class.
Wow.
And
is that what happens when you write a Bonhoeffer biography?
No. Okay. But I got on the plane, and the guy across from me. See, here's the thing that, you know, anybody who flies first class knows this is true. But I've only experienced this recently. That first class has a whole different caliber of jerk. It's like they're it's a certain first class kind of uptight, successful.
Yeah.
That's where the term first class comes from.
And so this has happened now three times where the guy across from me in first class is just uniquely prickly and you just know that.
Is it because you were witnessing to him?
He's ready to blow. I handed him a Jack Chick track, but this is true. He was just extremely prickly about where I put my luggage, and I thought, wow, I could have a fist fight now. Like we could throw down now on the plane.
And
it didn't happen.
Was that an exciting thought to you, or a scary thought?
From smacking him, but it's just extraordinary. But this is the third time now that I've you think, oh wow, cool, I'm first class, but very uptight people.
So do you think it's not worth it? Would you rather be?
I was thinking that on
some
level. Yeah, it's like a total wash. It's a total wash because you're with people that they're used to getting their way. Let's just assume they're
the
successful.
1%. Right.
Yes,
right.
It's 1%. But it just kills me that it. This morning I thought, here I am in first class with a first class jerk. Yeah.
Jerk.
Well, anyway,
that's why Phil and I only fly Southwest, which is like Soviet Airways. Right.
Right.
We're all one class.
Free of class.
Well,
free.
We're all in it together.
No
thank
class.
Thank God Almighty, we're free of class.
Yeah, and nobody owns the peanuts, so they're common.
Right.
You take what you want. Yeah. Okay. You went to Yale.
I did go
to Yale. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Danbury, Connecticut. I was born in Queens.
That's where my grandfather was from.
In Danbury, Connecticut?
Yeah, Charles, my grandfather.
No one's from Danbury, Connecticut. Yeah. What's the last name?
Well, he was adopted, but his adoptive family's name was Dunn.
Really?
D-U-N-N.
You know, they owe me money. That's not true. But the fact is that Danbury, Connecticut, it's a working class town. It's just far enough from New York City that it's out of the gravitational pull. Like when you think of Connecticut, people often think, you grew up in Darien. I said, no, not Darien, Danbury. Total working class, middle America. That's where I grew up.
There is no middle America in Connecticut.
Well, that's what people don't realize. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We have more in common with people had like gun racks and cowboy hats, and this is, because it's middle America. Yeah.
What do they have? Do you have a county fair? Is there a county fair there?
There was until 1981. Yeah. It was the state fair.
They canceled it in 81.
When Reagan was elected.
Well, what happened, this is not a joke. This is true. A developer bought the state fairgrounds and built a mall, and it's called the Danbury Fair Mall. And I can't say this publicly, but I hate it.
Do you hate the mall or the loss of fair?
Both.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So how'd you end up at Yale?
Well, I was a good kid. I studied hard, and I actually didn't get into Yale right out of the gate. I went to Trinity College in Hartford for my freshman year. And it's a weird thing. This is the downside of being in Connecticut, is that, you know, everyone in Connecticut applies to the Ivy League schools. So it's
okay.
And
it's
actually
assumed.
Danbury, Connecticut is the northernmost town in Fairfield County, which is like Greenwich and all these like, you know, towns where people went to Choate and, you know, Deerfield and these places. So in a way it's harder to get in to those schools. I didn't get in, and I was sort of young, but I transferred. And it's a weird thing.
What does sort of young mean? Like
12? I was 16, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
I graduated high school. Yeah, I was still 16, technically.
Okay.
And
you skipped grades?
I skipped first grade.
Or people got sick of you?
I skipped first grade.
They pushed them out.
Okay. Wow.
I mastered the colors. I got that like.
Do you regret it? Because then you were young and too small for sports, and your true calling may have been lost.
Actually, my parents were very, you know, as all European immigrants, they're very aggressive with education and stuff. So the doctor, my parents had the doctor introduce flashcards into my mother's womb in the second trimester.
Wow.
And I learned all my math basics and colors and
things.
But
we're born with some nasty paper cuts.
Right. Yeah. So I know the reality is that I did skip first grade. As strange as that is, I skipped first grade.
That's strange. Okay, so you ended up at Yale. What's it like for a? Were you a Christian at the time?
Grew up,
your parents Christian?
Greek Orthodox? I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church, which is mostly culturally Christian, right? In other words, I was an altar boy. We went to church every Sunday, but we never really heard the gospel.
Were you a funny altar boy?
No. Oh. No, this was before I became funny.
Oh, okay.
And I was, although we had funny altar boys, but we...
You were not one
not
of
worth
them.
Going
That's
into.
So disappointing.
But no, I was not. I was very earnest, you know, okay. A straight-A student, good kid, whatever. And nobody would have gotten my jokes anyway, so I just suppressed that whole
he was too
side
smart.
Of me. Yeah. And so I... But I
what a highbrow little boy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, although I didn't know what that was at the time, but probably
humor.
In retrospect. But it was a cultural experience. So it was a good experience growing up in the Greek Orthodox Church, but it was mainly the experience of being Greek. This is the Greek community, you know,
right.
and Greeks in a good way are sort of clannish. They hang out. And that was
my
world.
A big, fat Greek church.
In fact, today, this is not true, not a joke. I'm making a huge sacrifice by being here. This is totally true because I'm missing the Greek festival in Danbury, Connecticut, which started tonight. And I was thinking, I can't wait to go. And because I considered this podcast a divine appointment,
wow.
You wrecked my plans for the evening.
And
what
does the Greek festival in Connecticut entail?
It entails souvlaki.
Entails
what kind of a question is
his
that?
His family.
It's souvlaki, soda, and, baklava, and galaktoburiko, thamilame argotera.
Amen.
I hope I didn't swear. What did I just say?
Which verse was that?
So Greek, growing up in the Greek community, try to keep us focused here. Not that it's my job, of course, that's Phil's job. How crazy. but the fact is that I grew up in the Greek community, and I had a modicum of faith, but it was never discipled. In fact, when I was 12, somehow the Greek Orthodox Youth Association's little group, we got shunted off to a Russian Orthodox church for a Saturday retreat. And this would normally never happen. Greeks would never mix with non-Greeks.
Right.
But somehow we get to... And I heard the gospel at age 12 from this Russian Orthodox priest.
Wow.
And there's no question that it was delivered clearly. I received it. I prayed. It was this whole thing. And I remember from that moment on, it was the summer, either I turned 12 or 13, but I would pray by myself at night when I went to sleep or whatever. You know, it was like clearly God had done something, but there was no discipleship. So by the time I got to Yale, it had sort of evaporated enough. And Yale is an aggressively secular environment where, you know, if you go there with an open mind, you're in trouble. So I always say, if you have to go, just don't go with an open mind. But I did. And by the time I graduated, I was, you know, a full-bore pseudo-nihilist, you know.
Still Greek.
But fortunately, you're able to retain your Greek identity
now,
even going through Yale.
I have to ask then, are you heavily in debt, and are you going to ask us for a loan?
That's very funny. But the German side of me rebukes you. I'm half Greek and half German. And
Scandinavian side of me receives that
right.
as a neutral.
Yes.
Okay,
you were all neutral.
You came out of Yale. Here's what I'm intrigued about you.
Is there anything?
Yes.
I'm dying to hear
It's the very serious Eric Metaxas intention with the absolutely comedic Eric Metaxas. And because, you know, most of the people that I know, I've known you for a long time, most of the people that I know have only heard of you recently because of the Bonhoeffer book. So they read the Bonhoeffer book and they love it.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, Eric Metaxas. And I say, yeah, he is so funny. And they look at me like I'm crazy.
Like that's blasphemous.
Like,
how dare you?
How could he be? I just read he's such a serious-minded young altar boy.
Yeah. Well, the fact of the matter is that oddly, and I have to live with this, of course, both are true. I don't know quite what to do with it. I think my goal in life is to have a mainstream TV talk show where you have the breadth to be both. And also, I always reference my now friend, Dick Cavett. I mean, he had that. He was a comedian. He hung out with comedians. But his show, he would have incredibly earnest conversations with interesting, you know, intellectuals.
Right.
So I kind of think that the idea that you've got to be one or the other, it isn't true. But it has taken me a lot of time because it's almost like you're building a pyramid with a much wider base. So it takes longer to get up there because it's just you're trying to do two things at once. And it just is going to take longer. But
tell me about it.
Yes,
but don't
I know.
People typically like Jon Stewart? Definitely, he kind of represents that these days. But he started on the comedy side and just built it that way. And oh, by the way, I have a brain.
Right.
And then, but
although he is still mostly funny. Like he, even when he's serious, it's joking. Yeah. Like his persona is
sure
very funny.
But then there are people who are going to build it. I'm an intellectual. I'm smart. And by the way, I have a sense of humor. So right. Do you feel like you're building on one side of that more? I mean, with the Bonhoeffer book and all that, or are you really building from both sides?
I honestly think I don't. I've given up trying to figure it out. There was a time when I would have, you know, people have incessantly said to me over the decades, "You've got to choose," and. I'm at a point where I say, no, I don't think I do. I think I've got to be me. I've got to be who the Lord made me to be, and the Lord will direct my career. I certainly never planned to write a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's
see,
not,
the first thing you wrote that I bumped into was your parody of Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Surely my finest book.
Yes.
And in all seriousness, I am so proud of that, and no one knows it exists. If anybody goes to my website, ericmetaxas.com, let me say that again, ericmetaxas.com, if you go to ericmetaxas.com, then you see you missed it. I knew I would get you. Then you will see on the right-hand side, it says, Daily Don't You Believe It?
Oh, really?
And every day on the website, there's a page of that book posted. Because we have to explain, Phil, because I'm very proud of this, and people don't care about this, but I have to talk about this. But Ripley's Believe It or Not, when I was a kid, they were these goofy paperback books with insane facts.
Right.
Like, you know, the caliph of ancient Turkestan who had three eyes or whatever it was, right? Or two pupils in each eye or some insane fact or whatever. And it was right on the border of could it be true?
Right.
But theoretically, Ripley's Believe It or Not
believe
is
it
true.
Or
it's
not.
True. But I wrote a parody of this. So this is kind of like trying to parody the insane. It's a very high degree difficulty dive. And
also,
so everybody
also called
thinks,
Congress.
Everybody, I have no idea what that means, but go ahead. So the fact is that I think that everybody thinks they can do that.
Yeah.
But
no,
I've seen many, many bad parodies of Ripley's Believe It or Not. But I think that I wrote one that, anyway, I'm very proud of it. And, you can probably get used copies on Amazon.com.
Do you own it? Do you own it? Does it have the rights reverted? Could we reprint it?
Yes.
Can we
Well, this is why I need you in my life, because I would like to build a business around this insanity. I've got a whole other book.
One book? It's only one book.
Well, just to finish off. So in 1996, St. Martin's Press said, we'd like to publish this. And we got an illustrator who did a great job, Mark Dennis. And so it's a book of untrue facts. Everything in there is a lie. Except it really is by Eric Metaxas.
Like the group, this is the only one I remember, the group of French chefs who escaped the invading Nazis.
No, don't say it. I'll give it word for word.
That's my
this is literally
one.
The first one that I wrote, and so we put it on the cover. I wrote this in 1985 on the steps of Widener Library at Harvard. I was sitting there with a friend from Yale, and we said, we should write a parody book. Well, let's see if we can parody Ripley's Believe. And the first one we came up with, which is probably the best, is in World War I, chefs under siege in a mountainous region of Switzerland, buttered an entire mountainside and slid to safety. I'm sorry. You didn't have to laugh. But it's so
stupid.
Still
makes me laugh.
But if you,
I first read it 14 years ago, and I'm still laughing about it.
But if you
butter
but if
the
you
mountainside.
Know, and then it's dash, bold, italic, and slid to safety,
safety!
Exclamation
right,
point.
Because that's how they did it.
And then there's also Pokey, a slug with ESP, and, you know, whatever. That's on the cover. The Ursine Abbess, trained to ring the bells as a cub in 1542. She rose in the ranks of the order to become Mother Superior of the convent. You know, she was killed by poachers in 1549.
She's a bear.
It's a bear. The Ursine Abbess, trained as a cub to ring the bells. Anyway, the point is it's a book filled with non-facts.
The bells.
And, of course, it sold extraordinarily, Edgar Allan Poe, it sold extraordinarily poorly.
Yeah.
And because Irma Bombeck was competing with it. And But it's my – I'm so proud of it.
You were just ahead of your
I'm
time.
I'm thrilled that you brought it
I mean,
it
that's
up.
The Onion. Right,
yeah.
That's what the Onion ended up doing with news, modern news. We're just going to parody the
whole
thing.
Well, they parodied things that I guess we're more engaged in than old Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Well, the only thing
is
that, but it's one of those things that it's. We were talking about this before the microphones were turned on. But basically, that it, you know, you realize that if you can get stuff out there, maybe people will buy it. But if nobody's getting it out there, I mean, say Martin's Press did a very bad job because I was a no-name author and whatever, so nobody saw it. But the people that I've shared it with, if you have a weird kind of personality
and
sense of humor, like some of us do, you know, John Wilson at Books and Culture, it's his favorite book.
Well, but here's the problem: now you are you're no longer an unknown author, but you're known primarily for Bonhoeffer.
Right.
So if you were to put that book out today,
it would blow people's minds. That's my goal. That's my goal.
To blow people's minds.
Well, I guess I'm only half kidding, which is always the case. You see?
Now you need to pick another famous figure and do a parody biography of them that everyone will take seriously.
That's beautiful.
Well, see, like, the problem I have is I'm known sort of in the church leadership world, so right. I went to a publisher with a book idea, and they said, well, okay, we'll do that, but we want your next book to be for church leaders. I don't want to do another book for church leaders, but you get pigeonholed into that one thing. So,
right. It was a good idea for all of your humor things to fail miserably.
Perhaps.
So that you could do Bonhoeffer.
Right. Well, I think I can say
because if that Ripley's thing had taken off,
yeah. You would have never been allowed to
say,
do it.
Right. I'm not going to read his Bonhoeffer
That's
book.
Correct.
He's a jokester.
That's correct. Well, you know, I really do believe firmly that the Lord is in charge of my career, and I just do what I do, and I pray, and I expect Him to lead me. And I'm pretty convinced, especially lately, that that is the case. You know, you can always see these things in hindsight, but the very idea that I wrote these two biographies, the one is about William Wilberforce, and this one about, if you had talked to me, you know, a few years ago, and said, do you think you will ever write a biography? My answer would have been a firm no. Absolutely not a genre I'm interested in. And yet...
Well, let's get back to that in a second, because you're still at Yale. You just walked out of Yale a nihilist.
1984.
In 1984.
Yeah.
Then what? How did you come back? What happened?
Well, I got mugged by reality, and Jesus is the Lord of reality. It took 3 years, but I was trying to be a writer. I moved to Boston. I was kind of just... sort of unhappy, bouncing around, feckless, although I eventually invested in a good used feck. I just made that up, I'm sorry. But I was quite feckless.
Find him on eBay.
And I was, eventually things got so bad. I mean, I'm trying to be a writer. I wanted to be a literary writer in the...
Serious at that point?
Yes.
Or parody?
Well, this is the thing. While I was at Yale, you're quite right to ask, because while I was at Yale, I was the editor of the Yale Humor Magazine.
Right. Hmm.
So I was developing that side, and that really was when I sort of became funny and understood that, yeah, I can be funny.
So your first excursion into funny was editing the Yale Humor Magazine.
Well, was hanging out with the group of people who did that, and so it's almost like I developed the talent was always there, but there was never an audience. There were never friends that were on that wavelength very much and stuff. So it kind of, I would say it blossomed at Yale. So here I am, you know, interested in writing humor and funny stuff, but I was also very serious about literary fiction, and I thought I want to, you know, follow in the footsteps of Faulkner and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and John Cheever and John Updike and my heroes in that vein, Thomas Pynchon, whatever I was reading. I wanted to add to the canon of Western literature, and I was very serious about that, very intentional about it. I want to write a great novel. And so I graduated, you know, and how do you become a writer? Well, there's no plan. It's not doctor or, well, everyone says that. But
practice.
I was, you know, as I am now, as we now know, I was all over the place. And so it just didn't work out. And I ended up, although I got a number of accolades for things, I sold a couple of humor pieces to the Atlantic Monthly. And, you know, I got reasonable encouragement. But I ended up moving back in with my parents when I guess it was about 24. And, of course, that was bad because if your parents are European immigrants, don't move back in with them.
Right.
Because as far as they're concerned, you know, they didn't get to go to college. You went to Yale University. Maybe you should have a job and be helping support the team.
And they should move in with you.
And they should move in with you. So it was a tough year, and it was so bad that I was open to God in a way that I wouldn't have been at another time. And I got a really menial job as a proofreader at Union Carbide in Danbury, Connecticut, which was like, I think the Aramaic word is Gehenna. Or maybe that's the Hebrew word, is Gehenna.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pastor laughs because he understands what that is.
Sorry.
So you explain that to Phil
seminary
when we go to a commercial break. But the bottom line is it was a horrible time, and this man who was a born-again believer began to share with me. And it was interesting because I was in enough pain to say,
but he wasn't
keep
Russian.
Talking. No, I said, I was like, keep talking, but no, I don't want to pray with you. No, I don't want to go to church with you. You know, I was so inoculated against being a serious Christian through my secular Yale experience that I didn't want to be near these people, but I was in enough pain to say, but tell me more. And that went on for months. And then one night in this process where I'm living at home, I'm miserable, and this guy's sharing his faith with me, I had a dream. And I was sort of moving incrementally toward faith, but there was no way I was going to get there. And then one night, all I can say is the Holy Spirit, you know, came to me. Theologically, we know that we can't get there, but He comes to us. And it was one of those dreams that It's a long story. If you want the story, you have to go to ericmetaxas.com.
Sure.
And if you go to ericmetaxas.com, you can, on the right-hand side, right under the Don't You Believe It thing,
yes,
is the video of my conversion dream. But it was a mind-blowing dream. Jesus came to me in a way that, again, it's too complicated to explain. But I was dramatically born again, literally overnight, changed everything. And that led me, through a genuine miracle, to get a job with a company called Rabbit Ears Productions, writing children's books. And I was not...
they wrote great children's
books. I was not interested in writing children's books, but the Lord led me dramatically, sovereignly to do this. And, of course, what I discovered in writing these... they're sort of like adaptations of folk tales and that kind of stuff. It's almost like I realized that that's closer to my voice than trying to write an Ann Beattie short story for The New Yorker or whatever was in vogue in terms of fiction at that point. And so I started writing children's books, which, of course, at some point led me to VeggieTales.
Right, right. But where did Breakpoint come in?
Breakpoint was before, well, I was, so then I became a Christian, and now I floundered as a Christian. So we know that one flounders differently as a Christian.
Sure.
And I shouldn't say that. For 4 years, first of all, I worked for Rabbit Ears, writing all these children's books. And I kind of got involved in, you know, media, TV, film scripts. Nothing ever got produced, but I began nibbling around that world. And so it kind of launched my children's book writing career. I've written 30 children's books by now, I guess. And I was in 96, I got married, and right around that time I decided I needed a real job, and what can I do? And so I got a job, a horrible job, working as a copywriter for an ad agency in New York City. And the ad agency is gray advertising, and mm-hmm. it's known in the industry
right.
to be
sure.
genuinely gray, creatively gray. Everything that all the really creative organizations don't want
to
do,
yeah,
like they'll do, like
them.
Red Lobster will do it, like X-Lax will do it, whatever you got, we'll do it.
Okay.
So I wrote one TV ad in a year, one ad that got produced, got put on TV.
Wow.
And the brand was X-Lax. Thank you.
Wow.
So,
it's like a Mad Men episode.
I'm sorry. Wow. So I wrote an X-Lax commercial, but it was the worst.
That must have been kind of the pinnacle.
It was so bad.
Were your parents proud?
No, that's funny. That's funny. You're a bad
no.
man.
No.
So it was a horrible year working in advertising. And one day I get a phone call from Breakpoint at the Chuck Colson's ministry, and I so admired Chuck when I first became a believer in 1988.
And how did they hear about you? It wasn't the X-Lax.
I'll tell you how they heard about
me.
They
were big X-Lax fans.
They had writer's block.
In 1993 or 4 or 5, someplace around there, when I was living in New Canaan, Connecticut, I heard that Chuck Colson was going to be speaking at Yale University. Now, I graduated Yale in 84, but was only about 45 minutes away. And I said, yeah. I have got to hear Chuck Colson. I so admired him. I'd read his book. When I became a believer in 88, I started to read everything he wrote. And it was just a dream that I could get to hear him and maybe meet him in person. So I went to Yale. It was actually at the law school, and I heard him speak. And I was so excited about this that I wrote a letter to him and put it in one of my children's books for his grandkids. And I, as he was leaving, I thrust it at him. And a week later, I get this glorious letter from Chuck Colson thanking me for my letter and just
wow.
saying that he would sort of keep me in mind in the future, our paths may cross or whatever. And sure enough, you know, about 2 years later, I got this... invitation to apply for a writing job at Breakpoint.
Right.
They have editors and writers, a whole editorial team. And I thought, this is a dream come true to get to work with my hero, Chuck
right.
Colson. I just loved him so much and admired
him. Did he invite you
him.
To bring your humor?
No. Oh. I had checked the humor at the door.
Yeah.
But, it's a pretty serious operation.
It's pretty serious, yeah. And so that was, but I worked there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the Lord appointed a tomato to.
Do you remember where we met?
I think we met at the launch of, it was like at Universal Studios.
Yeah, it was at the Hard Rock Live.
What town was that?
Orlando. We were in Orlando.
Yeah, that's
at
right.
The
okay.
Hard Rock Live, yeah. And it was the premiere of Larry Boy and the Rumor Weed.
That's right. By the way, we met because of, I think, Bill Halgen or somebody. But I don't even remember how I met.
Yeah, I don't know how you got invited.
I have no idea.
Now Bill's the pants guy, right?
Bill's the pants guy. Yeah.
And although we're wearing pants, just to be clear for the audience.
Yes.
But Bill
is the funny pants.
It was
right.
Bill, But I don't remember how that happened. Somehow people were saying, and I had no as much as I admired VeggieTales at the time, which I certainly did, I had no ambition to work for VeggieTales or anything. I just thought, well, whatever, you know, I'm writing children's books and stuff. And, of course, I left Breakpoint and that incredible ministry salary to to work. I got such a good salary at VeggieTales that it brought Big Idea down. It's like the whole thing went bankrupt.
Too many eggs in one basket, and the whole thing.
Yeah,
went down.
Well, it was the sudden outpouring of VeggieTales writing with very high end references from that only a Yale graduate
now
intellectual produce.
We have to say this on the air because I wherever I go, I try to work this in because I'm so proud of it, Phil. Said to me, you know, we're doing a new VeggieTale, and it's going to be it's hosted by Archie Asparagus, so it's going to be kind of highbrow, snooty, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd like to write a Gilbert and Sullivan parody, you know, as only Phil Vischer could do. And he said, but I think maybe there's room for a young punk like you, Eric. Maybe you could do a Shakespeare parody for VeggieTales. And I just thought, that's just like, you know, giving me a cake with extra icing. The opportunity to write a veggie Shakespeare parody. So I just was probably literally drooling at the prospect. And, of course, I came up with the now famous Hamlet parody.
Yeah.
So I'm so proud of that. And everywhere I go, I try to tell people, I wrote the Hamlet Omelet parody. And they often cheer.
I'm sure they do.
But not as loudly as when I say I'm the narrator on the Esther video.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, I didn't realize
you
that.
Were.
Oh, yes, because they all had Chicago accents. Yeah. It wasn't working.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. That's on my tombstone. Everywhere I go to talk about Bonhoeffer, I initially have to introduce myself, and I mention that I, you know, have written for VeggieTales. And people, of course, they assume that I'm you or that I invented it. And I want you to know that I publicly let them know that's not the case because it's embarrassing. But the fact is that when I say people that I'm the narrator, I'm the voice of the narrator on the Esther video, and people like kind of lose their heads. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah, we have to have security. They go crazy because they're so enamored of VeggieTales, which I believe, Phil, you probably had something to do with. And so they go so crazy, and I always explain that I'm a narrator, so I'm a non-pictured vegetable. No one knows what it's a vegetable universe, so clearly the narrator is a vegetable.
Right. Well, when you performed the role, how did you picture yourself?
It was kind of a Lee Strasberg thing. I felt that I was a Broccoli Rob.
Really?
Yeah.
Deep down inside.
Yeah, I was channeling Broccoli. I was trying to be, but who knows? The people listening.
You did it. I think you pulled it off.
So if you listen to Esther, it really is kind of weird because they needed a New York gangster accent. And I remember, you know, Mike Naraki was saying, "Well, give me a little Joe Pesci, So we did that,
and
somehow they used it. I don't know.
You kicked it out of the park. Do you remember any lines from Esther? Could you do it?
I think I'm just going to like morph into Pa Grape because of what you just did.
Okay, so now how did we get? This is where it gets interesting. How did you get from writing Omelet to writing Wilberforce?
I left VeggieTales and then
shortly before VeggieTales left,
floundered for a season. If you say season, it sounds biblical and okay. I floundered for a season, and then I drifted for another couple of seasons. And I'll tell you what happened. In 2004, I finally said, okay, I need to start, writing books, adult books. And I wrote a book with a silly title, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God, But Were Afraid to Ask.
Right.
Because as soon as I became a Christian in 1988, I said, how have I grown up in a world where basic facts about the faith, nobody seems to know them, and people are afraid to ask their born-again neighbor because, he'll let them have it with both barrels and they don't want to go there. But everybody has these questions, right? So I wrote a book with the title Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God, But We're Afraid to Ask, which combines serious apologetics with humor. And in that book, everything...
Hey, ring the bell.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so into the conversation.
I'm sorry. I know. I'm trying to mesmerize you.
Distracted driving.
So I wrote Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God, But We're Afraid to Ask, and amazingly got on CNN to talk about it. And this is around Christmas time, December 2005.
There you go, Christmas. That's why at Christmas time, Easter, they'll say,
"That's right.
We needed a religious story here.
Yeah,
somebody give us something.
Put them on the cover.
Yeah, sort of. So I'm on CNN talking about this, and the anchor, actually this even the video of this clip is on my website, ericmetaxas.com.
Wow.
Have I mentioned that?
I think so.
But the woman on CNN asks me, instead of asking me the hard question, which I was expecting, right? I'm expecting this is CNN. They're going to say, how can a good God allow suffering? They're really trying to challenge me. She says to me very cheerfully, you know, there's something in your book about history. You mentioned something. What's this about Wilberforce? So in this whole book of apologetics, I just mention William Wilberforce briefly, and I say, here's a guy who took the Bible so seriously that he changed the world, right? Well, suddenly I'm on national TV talking about Wilberforce. Next thing I know, I get contacted by somebody at Harper San Francisco saying, would you like to write a biography of Wilberforce? Because there's a movie coming out called Amazing Grace.
Which was from Walden Media.
It's the 2007. It's the bicentennial of the abolition of the slave trade. So they're making this movie. I already knew about the movie. But they said, would you like to write a biography to come out with the movie? And it was one of those moments where you think, well, gosh, you know, it's a little bit like when you said, would you like to write a Shakespeare veggie parody? There are moments when my mind is suddenly engaged. I go, yes, this is, you're sort of drooling, intellectually drooling, thinking this could be fun because I like the period of time. And I prayed about it, and I can say that the Lord spoke to me in a vision. Am I allowed to say that on this podcast?
Yeah, why not?
People think I'm kidding.
I think so.
But it was one of those rare
he's
cases.
He's not kidding. He's not smiling or smirking.
It's one of those rare cases in my life where the Lord spoke to me. As I was praying, I had a vision. It's quite dramatic, actually. It's like a TV set in your head, and this has only happened to me like three times in my life. But it was quite dramatic, and I knew that the Lord wanted me to write that book. And so I wrote it. It was very hard to write, but it was also fun. And then everyone kept asking me, who will you write about next? And if you hear that often enough, you think, well, maybe I should write another biography.
Right.
And
now,
that's what led to the story of Bonhoeffer.
Did the Wilberforce book do well enough? Did you get any checks in the mail?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay. But before you wrote Wilberforce, was he a strong interest of yours?
Oh, absolutely. No, Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer are just two of these names, people that on a very surface level, I knew who they were, I admired them, but I knew, you know, not so much. But I knew enough to know that these are people that maybe, I would...
I know in the Bonhoeffer book you mentioned the family, your family background and your interest in this topic and all that, but I have to confess I have not read your Wilberforce book, so
very,
I didn't...
Very few people have, and let me say this. It is... everybody who has read both, half of those people think it's better than Bonhoeffer,
really?
And the other half think... But yeah, I'm very hugely proud of the Wilberforce book titled Amazing Grace... William Wilberforce.
I kind of thought when I first saw it come out, I kind of thought it was a novelization of the movie because they were marketed together.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people thought that, and it is dramatically not the case. In fact, I went out of my way. They sent me a copy of the movie script, so I didn't even want to know. I just said, I want to write a bona fide biography of this great man. And, you know, I used almost all original sources, and I am hugely proud of that book. And I'm proud of the writing in that book. And that's part of what made me, you know, drool at the thought of it. I thought to exercise my literary muscles to be able to write a kind of literary biography that tells the story, that tells it well. I'm not an academic, I'm not an historian, but, you know, I can write. And I really felt that this is an important story. And I, you know, I'm tremendously proud of that. And I'm happy that people from Bonhoeffer, they say, well, what else has he written? A lot of people are now reading Amazing Grace because they like Bonhoeffer.
Right. I'm sure Phil has not read it because he only reads books that he's mentioned in.
What? I've read Bonhoeffer. I didn't read Amazing Grace.
Actually, Amazing Grace is much shorter. And it just happens to have a happy ending.
Bonhoeffer is lengthy.
Yeah,
it is substantial.
And it gets very dark.
Some would even say long. But actually, it has a a happy ending. Amazing Grace does, and it's.
I saw the movie.
It's a quicker
so,
read.
So you know, I figured that's.
Well, actually, that's the point. Yeah. Is that what I was just going to say? Is that the movie? When the movie came out, I thought, okay, it's decent, but because it's a movie, they can't go into
Hardly
so
anything.
Much stuff that is so key to this man's life, and I get to write about it. His conversion.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
All right. Write the book.
Read the book. Yeah, I've written it, but you can just read it. But actually, it is one of those things where there's so much key stuff. I mean, his what was called a Reformation of Manners, which had nothing to do with the slave trade. It was kind of like he wanted to change the culture, like we've talked about. That alone is a primer for Christians who want to, right, you know, change the world.
Well, I'm in the middle of, and I'm rereading it, Neil Ferguson's book on the rise and decline of the British Empire. There's a whole chapter of that book devoted to the Clapham sect.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
You know, which, mm-hmm, these were the people that changed the morals of the Western world.
But even that, I mean, it's a lot amazing. Of people are wanting to change the culture nowadays. But with Wilberforce, and this is picked up a little bit in the movie, it's much more substantial in his biography, is he was sort of a mystic. I mean, he was about deep communion with God as the foundation out of which then came,
right,
cultural engagement.
Well, I wouldn't say he was a mystic just because there's some connotations,
well,
there.
Yeah.
He was no Meister Eckhart, and I just wanted to... Is that the secret word? Do I get $100?
Ring the bell.
Mm. The bell is now becoming meaningless,
yeah,
because,
right,
it's applied to
that's
too,
right,
many things.
But
well,
the fact is that Wilberforce was a profoundly serious, you know, conservative, evangelical Christian, if we're going to give those labels. This was a man who memorized the scriptures, who loved the scriptures, who loved Jesus Christ, who talked about the sweetness of his relationship,
right,
with the Savior. So to me, the beauty of the reason I think his story is particularly important is that this was a time when, in effect, nobody was a Christian, and suddenly through the Methodist movement, mm-hmm, and all that, you get this flowering of Christianity, which expresses itself in both ways simultaneously. In other words, you have people who care about evangelism and theology and Bible reading,
right,
and at the same time, they're doing good works. They're helping the poor. They're working in politics to abolish, you know, or to have better child labor laws, and to on and on and on to prevent,
right,
cruelty,
right,
to animals. Both go together. And for so long in our, you know, more recent history, in the last 100 years, there's been this division,
right,
where you have some people say, I want to focus on evangelism, and you have other people say, I want to focus on the social gospel, I'm going to feed the poor, but I don't care if Jesus actually rose from the dead. Well, you know, biblically, you don't get to choose. The gospel is inevitably both together, and at the time of Wilberforce, you see both,
right,
together.
But and that's really instructive, but what I find most intriguing is, especially as I get around the country, I hear a lot of young people who are, they're very activistic. They want to end poverty in 30 days, and they're going to change the culture, or maybe they're going to evangelize, whatever their activism,
right,
is. But for them, at least my cynical investigation of it, I then begin to ask them, well, tell me about your communion with Christ.
That's the point, yeah.
And it's hollow. It's not there.
Yeah.
And they're building all their significance into their activism.
Yeah.
But with Wilberforce, you see, it's profoundly central.
That's right.
And out of that erupts this amazingly beautiful, holistic Christian engagement with the culture. So,
right,
it's the
best of liberal and conservative together. I mean, we've been forced to choose in you know, again, in recent history, we've been given this false choice. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, at the heart of the gospel is always both. And the fact that you can pull one out and say, well, I like this, but I don't like that. Like, I want to sleep with my girlfriend, but I want to, you know, be involved in human trafficking, you know, abolishing. I want to do hip stuff that Christians do, but I'm not going to take this other stuff too seriously. Well,
right,
you don't get a choice. You're forced to deal with both. And anybody who thinks I can just do evangelism and theology, but I don't care about the poor, either one is a false choice. Wilberforce, to me, is just a glorious example of both together, and
mm-hmm,
it led to a whole movement. I mean, I dedicate the book to the Claphamites of the 21st century, that people who are going to get both and are going to understand that what you do should be fueled by this relationship with the Lord, because then out of that gratitude comes this desire to do his work and to bless his children. So I think it's huge.
Is that same theme picked up I read Bonhoeffer, but it seems like that you
to
brought that
extent,
theme into,
yeah,
that book as well, that this was part of Bonhoeffer's experience, that it was a more... even the way he engaged scripture, the way he taught his students,
right,
to engage with God, it was somewhat different than the popular German view.
Yeah, and the word would be holistic, like you just said, I mean, which I hate because it's kind of a buzzword, but it's the word to understand that it's integrated, it's both. You don't get to be, you know, highly theological, but then people say, well, I don't see it in your life. The two have to be one. And Bonhoeffer's theology, in a way, you could say, was that your life is your theology,
mm-hmm,
right? That if you cannot translate these highfalutin theological ideas into living for God in this dirty world, then they're just ideas, they're meaningless, and you're a hypocrite.
Right,
it's just fig,
right,
leaf ideas,
right,
to cover up the fact that you don't... You
and
don't
if I'm recalling,
anything.
It was when he went to Barcelona and became essentially a youth pastor in some capacity that he began to wrestle with, how do I take this academic training in theology and actually apply it to the lives of the people I'm called to shepherd?
That was part of it. I mean, I think that it's always there with him in a way, but there are moments, you're,
yeah,
right. The Barcelona thing, he starts working for the first time he's away from home. He's like 22, and he's away from home, and now he's dealing with indigents, poor people, criminals. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of wrestling with that as a pastor, as a young pastor, and it forced him to deal with that. But even before that, he loved to teach Sunday school. He really seemed to get this idea that it has to be both together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all through his life. And that, to me, is what makes him such a towering figure. And I think that probably the reason some folks who are maybe theologically liberal didn't like my book is because, in a funny way, I would argue that he's been misrepresented for decades as somebody who was not so serious about devotions, about praying, asking the Holy Spirit to speak to him through the Scriptures. All of that stuff they sort of ignored, or many people in the Bonhoeffer academic world kind of ignored that side of him. Mm-hmm. But you realize, as with Wilberforce, the two were one.
Right.
What fueled his ability to heroically stand up to the Nazis was his love for Jesus Christ. And to say, to not see that is kind of to miss everything,
right.
I think.
Right.
Okay, so speaking of towering figures that you're fond of, Chuck Colson recently passed away. For a lot of kids out there, you know, 20, 25, some of them aren't even familiar with him. What?
Some of them haven't even heard of us. It's unbelievable. They haven't heard of anybody.
Right. I guess from your perspective, what should someone know about Chuck Colson?
Well, Colson, when I came to faith in 88, I just remember kind of finding out about Colson and being so blown away. Colson was a bad guy in the Nixon administration, a hard-hitting, you know, kind of combination of, like, if you could think of the worst caricature of Karl Rove and Don Rumsfeld and Kissinger and Dick Cheney, you know, right?
Somebody all Republicans.
Like that. Yeah. Well, I'm just doing that for the hipster Christians listening to this podcast, right? And so the fact of the matter is that he was all that, and Watergate happened, and he was at the pinnacle of power at age 40. He had an office next to the president of the United States. He was this hugely powerful guy. And it all kind of came crashing down around him, and he was dramatically born again. And nobody believed it. People thought, oh, sure, how convenient.
Right.
What a hypocrite. What a jerk. He's just going to use this to try to get a lesser sentence, you know, from the prosecutor, whatever it is. But his conversion was utterly genuine, and he was just turned inside out. And
he
humbled himself.
What bothered me, that the Time magazine eulogy basically said, described him as a man who spent most of his life trying to do penance for his early life.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a tone in that he's driven out of guilt.
Yeah.
You know, that he's driven out of trying to make up for.
Rather than gratitude.
But
that's classic mainstream media. They don't get this stuff. So we're going to have to give him a pass, as we've been doing for the last 80 years.
Knowing him fairly well, did you find him driven out of guilt?
Not even slightly.
Yeah.
What a joke. I mean, this guy was as profoundly converted as anyone you'll ever meet, as Wilberforce or anybody. This guy was profoundly changed by the gospel of Jesus Christ, and he lived his life out of gratitude for what God had done for him. God gave him a second chance, and he wrote a book called Born Again. He wrote a book called Loving God. I recommend that very highly. Loving God is just a Christian classic. I'll never forget reading that book for the first time. But he wrote all these amazing books, and I, as a Christian, you know, graduated from Yale, and now I've become one of these crazy born-again Christians, and I realized that, you know, you don't have to check your mind at the door.
Right.
Chuck Colson was a full-blown, serious, devout, earnest Christian who was an intellectual, a genius, very successful in the world. And so I read all of his books.
And what do you think he had more impact with, his prison work or, you know, the writing and intellectual stuff?
Well, I think in his case, the two are one, because you have a situation where what gave him credibility was the fact that he's spending most of his time in prisons preaching the gospel to people on death row. Well, he lived that.
Okay.
And because he lived that, what he wrote, you know, it affected what he wrote.
So that was kind of like his church. And that was his congregation.
In some ways,
Then he preached and wrote out of there.
Yeah.
Okay. So we should not forget about him.
Well, not only should not forget about him, but I happened to be I introduced what became his last speech. It was just about, 2 months ago now. I introduced him, and he got up, thundering applause, and in the middle of the speech, he had this cerebral hemorrhage. He was taken to the hospital and, you know, never recovered. Died, of course, as most of us know, not so long ago. And I was asked to take over Breakpoint Radio, which I used to write for, as we just said a few minutes ago. Now I'm the voice of Breakpoint, breakpoint.org. No bell.
Sorry.
I thought .org doesn't get a bell.
He said no bell because it's a nonprofit.
Sorry.
There's
but
no
anyway,
product.
Breakpoint.org is sort of,
I'm a nonprofit.
Sort of commentary.
Yeah, I'm not ringing the bell for you either.
You did for my books.
Oh, well, they're okay.
All right. Sorry.
Well, I'm glad we scratched the surface in this hour together.
It was awesome. Last thing, do you live in New York? Where are you living now?
I live in New York City with my wife and daughter.
And is that hard, being a, you know...
It's hard paying the rent.
Yeah.
It's very hard.
Here's a question. Do you think young, bright Christian kids should move to big cities?
The answer to that is a simple yes.
And they're there. We've met them.
I think that... Yeah, you don't want
to
hang out
there.
Well, don't hang out in the Wheaton area. Your faith will die on the vine. But if you, what God is doing in New York is actually extraordinary. My wife and I feel genuinely called to New York City, and amazing things have been happening in the 20 years that I've been there. It's clear that God is moving. There are churches popping up that I've never been to, never heard of. It's just extraordinary, extraordinary. You may have heard Tim Tebow move there. Obviously, Jeremy Lin is there. But I have to tell you, things are happening, and there's something about the realness of New York that forces you. You can't really have a fake faith.
Right.
You can't.
Right.
It's not Dallas where you can be culturally Christian. It's, you know, you can't.
There goes another region for our podcast.
No. Let me just tell you, I love Dallas. I go there just because I love it. I go there all the time, actually. But I'm just saying, New York is not like Dallas. Maybe that's why I love Dallas, because I need, you know, to hang with my peeps who actually believe all this crazy stuff, but and believe in guns. That's me, but I live, you know, I'm a blue state, Yale, horn-rimmed, you know...
Tweety. I think you're Tweety.
...character living in a red state. What? What is he saying?
Tweedy. I don't know what that means.
Tweety?
Yes, the tweed jacket.
Oh, tweed.
You know,
tweed.
With the elbow. No, not tweet.
No, he said Tweedy.
Tweedy.
Yeah. But Tweety.
I'm not as Tweety. I think I used to be Tweedier, but we can talk about that another time.
Okay.
He's too visual for the podcast.
Okay. Well, Eric Metaxas, it was great to have you here.
Thanks, Eric. Great conversation.
I wish we had more time. This is fun for me. Let me trust me when I tell you this
we
is fun.
We should do a talk show.
I would.
Later on. And you can play the role of Dick Cavett.
All right. I'll try.
And I'll be me. I'll be Bob the Tomato interviewing Dick Cavett.
Okay. I can pull that
off. That could be fun. You know, I did I recorded a VeggieTales country music album yesterday and this morning.
I am jealous.
Yeah. And I just have to tell you what the highlight was.
Country music. Yeah.
Bob the Tomato singing Jesus Take the Wheel.
Well, Bob's got no arms. Someone has to take the wheel.
I'm not kidding. And I was dreading it, but after we recorded it, it's like, well, that's
more fun than a person
actually
should
kind
be allowed
of fun.
To have.
That was actually kind of fun.
That is.
And Mr. Lunt singing "I Will Always Love You," the Dolly Parton version.
You have that kind of range?
If I'm forced to.
Wow.
If I'm forced to. So that will be coming out, I don't know when, probably this fall, if you want to hear such lunacy. Anyway, thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week with yet another guest having another fascinating discussion. Oh, yeah, we need to wrap it up with a song. Pull out the ukulele. This was my podcast. I had a big blast. We talked to Eric Metaxas. This was my podcast. Bonhoeffer and Wilberforce and Chuck Colson. He's not an Olsen twin. He's smarter and taller and more thoughtful in his writing. Yeah, thanks for coming. We'll see you next time on the Phil Vischer Podcast. Good night, everybody.